Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really big one, the Affordable Care Act.
Right, Obamacare.
Exactly, Obamacare. We've got a lot of great information here, mainly from a document called PPACADetails.pdf. And our goal for you, the learner, is to really get a handle on this legislation. It's complex, definitely polarizing.
It really is. And we want to cut through some of the noise, you know, highlight the key parts and what they actually meant on the ground.
Yeah, extract the important insights, not just list facts.
Because the ACA, it touches everything, doesn't it? Healthcare delivery, sure, but also politics, ideology.
Even how we think about sort of social responsibility.
Precisely. It's politics, it's a legal thing, and it's just woven into the national conversation now.
And it's key to remember, this didn't just pop up out of nowhere. It landed in a very divided political climate.
Passed with no Republican support, which is a big deal in itself.
Right, and immediately sparked these huge debates about government's role, individual liberty.
What the American safety net should even look like.
So, to really get our heads around it, we need to see it from multiple angles.
Yeah.
Maybe start with the history. The long road that led up to it.
Yeah, that's crucial because, honestly, the ACA wasn't the start of healthcare reform efforts. It was more like the culmination of, well, over a century of trying.
A century?
Seriously. Go back to 1912, Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party.
Okay.
Their platform was already talking about social insurance, you know, protecting people against sickness, losing their jobs.
So even then, they saw the vulnerability.
Yeah, recognizing how industrialization was changing things for workers. It's not a new idea at all.
That does put it in perspective. Okay, so fast forward to, say, the late 2000s, just before the ACA. What was the system actually like? What were the big problems?
Well, connecting that history to the immediate trigger for the ACA, the system was incredibly fragmented, just broken in many ways.
Leaving a lot of people out.
A huge number. In 2008, we're talking 46.3 million people uninsured. That's over 15% of the population. And, you know, it wasn't just one group. It hit low-income folks hard, young adults starting out, minorities, people working for small businesses.
But importantly, these weren't all, like, non-citizens or people not working?
No, not at all. That's a key point. The vast majority were U.S. citizens. Most were actually in working families. They just couldn't get or afford coverage.
So it wasn't just about having insurance, was it? What if you did have it?
Yeah.
Were you safe then?
Oh, that brings up the whole issue of underinsurance. It's a really critical point.
Underinsurance.
Yeah, even if you had a policy, a serious illness could still wipe you out financially. Medical bills. They were a factor in something like 62% of personal bankruptcies.
62%. That's staggering.
It is. And here's a real kicker. About 78% of those people filing for bankruptcy due to medical bills, they had health insurance when they first got sick.
So the insurance just wasn't good enough.
Exactly. It highlights this massive problem of policies that just didn't protect you when you really needed it, when you faced a major health crisis.
That's shocking. And okay, for the millions with no coverage, the consequences must have been terrible.
Absolutely devastating. If you don't have insurance, you face huge barriers just getting basic care, let alone specialized treatment.
So you delay care.
You delay care. Problems get worse. Health outcomes are poorer. In fact, there was a study back in 2009 that estimated nearly 45,000 deaths every year were linked to not having insurance.
45,000 deaths.
Yeah. Made it a major cause of death for working age adults. And think about the strain on the system itself. Public hospitals, community clinics, ERs becoming the place of last resort.
Right. The safety net was stretched thin.
Immense strain. Plus, the rising costs of Medicare and Medicaid were putting huge pressure on government budgets, too.
And what was driving those costs up? Was it just more people needing care or something else?
It was a mix of things, really. An aging population, definitely.
Yeah.
Expensive new technologies and drugs coming online all the time.
Chronic diseases.
Big factor. Increasing rates of chronic diseases. Administrative waste and inefficiency played a role, too. But there were deeper structural issues,
yeah.
Like the fee-for-service model, you know, where doctors and hospitals get paid for each service they provide.
Which incentivizes more services.
Exactly. Not necessarily better care or more efficient care, just more. And the system was heavily geared towards treating sickness after it happened, rather than investing upfront in prevention.
Which probably costs more in the long run.
Definitely has long-term cost implications.
Okay, so the picture you're painting is a system really buckling under the pressure, financially, yep. Socially, medically.
Pretty much. Lots of cracks showing.
Which really sets the stage for why there was such a push for reform, even knowing it would be a political fight.
Yeah.
So how did the ACA actually navigate Congress That legislative battle must have been intense.
Oh, it was. The House passed its version first, the Affordable Health Care for America Act, but very narrowly, very partisan.
And that one included the public option.
Yes, the House bill had a government-run insurance plan as an option. But the Senate, that was always going to be the tougher challenge.
Why specifically?
The filibuster rules. The Democrats, led by Harry Reid, needed 60 votes to overcome Republican opposition. Not 51, but 60.
So every single Democrat and independent aligned with them had to be on board.
Every single one, which gave enormous leverage to the more moderate Democrats in the caucus.
And the public option.
That became a major sticking point. To get those crucial 60 votes, the public option had to be dropped. It was a big compromise.
So the Senate passes its version, also on a party line vote?
Yeah, strictly party lines. And the plan then was to go to what's called reconciliation, basically, merging the House and Senate bills into one final version.
Sounds like some serious political maneuvering, a real high-stakes drama. Who were the key players steering this thing?
Well, you absolutely have to start with President Obama. His personal commitment was huge.
Driven by his own family's experience, right?
Yeah.
His mother.
Exactly. Her struggles with insurance companies while battling cancer, that deeply affected him. He consistently framed healthcare reform as both a moral issue, a right, and an economic necessity.
And in Congress.
Harry Reid in the Senate was indispensable. Just holding that diverse Democratic caucus together was a massive feat.
And the committee chairs, they must have been critical.
Absolutely. People like Max Baucus in Senate Finance, Ted Kennedy initially, then Chris Dodd in the HELP committee, Henry Waxman in the House Energy and Commerce. They were deep in the weeds, crafting the actual policy.
What about behind the scenes, policy advisors?
Sure. Folks like Peter Orszag at OMB really focused on the budget numbers, the fiscal sustainability piece. And Ezekiel Emanuel, a physician himself, pushing hard on delivery system reform, not just coverage, but changing how care is provided.
So it was this mix of idealism and pragmatism.
I think that's a good way to put it. The Obama administration was trying to balance this big vision of expanding coverage with the messy realities of politics and what the existing institutions could actually handle.
So looking back, the passage itself, what did it really signify beyond just being a new law?
Well, it's insightful, isn't it? The whole process showed both the potential and, frankly, the limitations of trying to do big transformative reform in the U.S. system.
How so?
It proved major changes possible, but wow, look at the hurdles. The incredibly narrow margins, the deep, deep partisan divide, all the procedural hoops you have to jump through in Congress.
It really highlights how tough it is.
Especially for something as personal, as complex, and as politically charged as healthcare. It really underscored the unique challenges of our system.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier that the U.S. was kind of an outlier globally on healthcare. By 2009, how did we stack up?
Well, if you connect this to the bigger global picture, by then the U.S. was basically the only wealthy industrialized country that didn't have some kind of system for near universal healthcare.
Everyone else had figured something out.
In different ways, yes. There's a whole range of models out there. You've got single payer systems like Canada or the U.K. where the government is essentially the main insurer. Then you have countries like, say, Switzerland or the Netherlands. They use regulated private insurance markets, but crucially, they also have mandates requirements for people to have coverage.
Interesting. Did any of these international models influence the ACA directly?
To some extent, yeah. Specific ideas were definitely looked at. Things like how Australia negotiates drug prices, or how Germany uses risk adjustment to balance costs among insurers. Elements like those found their way into the discussion, if not always the final law.
So the big takeaway is
that healthcare systems really reflect a country's values, you know, the choices that society makes about risk, responsibility, and the role of government. There isn't just one way to do it.
That's a really crucial point. Okay, let's dive into the ACA itself now. The nuts and bolts. What were the key provisions and what was the thinking behind them? Maybe start with the individual mandate that was hugely controversial.
Hugely. The individual mandate requiring most people to have insurance or pay a penalty, it was probably the most debated piece. And a novel use of federal power, arguably.
And the rationale was?
Primarily to combat adverse selection. That's the big one.
Adverse selection, meaning?
Meaning, if you let people wait until they're sick to buy insurance, who's going to sign up? Mostly sick people, right?
Right. Which drives up costs for everyone in that pool.
Exactly. Premiums would likely skyrocket. So the idea behind the mandate was you need to get everyone in the pool, healthy people, sick people, to keep it stable and theoretically more affordable, especially since the law was also saying insurers couldn't deny coverage anymore based on pre-existing conditions. The two pieces were meant to work together.
That makes sense, logically at least.
Yeah.
Okay, what about the other big changes to how insurance markets worked?
Right, there were some fundamental reforms there. Big ones. Guaranteed issue and renewability.
Which mean?
Insurers couldn't deny you coverage just because you had a health condition before, like diabetes or cancer history. And they couldn't refuse to renew your policy for that reason either.
That's massive.
Game changing, especially for people buying their own insurance. Then there was community rating.
Community rating.
Basically limiting how much insurers could vary premiums based on your health status. They could still adjust based on age, within limits, where you live, family size, tobacco use, but not just because you were sick.
Okay. And essential health benefits.
That was another key piece. It mandated that all qualified health plans had to cover a standard set of 10 categories of services, things like hospitalization, prescription drugs, maternity care, mental health services.
So no more junk plans that didn't really cover anything.
Well, it was the goal, to set a minimum standard. Plus, allowing young adults to stay on their parents' plans until age 26. That was very popular early on.
I remember that one.
And requiring coverage of certain preventive services, checkups, screenings, vaccinations, with no out-of-pocket costs for the patient.
So the idea behind all these market reforms was...
to level the playing field, really. Make the individual and small group markets work better, where competition would hopefully be based more on price and quality rather than just trying to avoid sick people.
Okay. But even with those reforms, insurance can still be expensive.
Sure.
What did the ACA do to help people actually afford the coverage?
Yeah. Affordability was central. This is where the major financial assistance came in. Two main types.
Okay.
First, premium tax credits. These are subsidies, basically, to help lower the monthly premium cost for individuals and families. They scaled based on income, available up to 400% of the federal poverty level.
So targeted help based on need.
Right. And second, cost-sharing reductions, or CSRs. These were additional subsidies specifically for lower-income folks who enrolled in silver-level plans on the marketplaces.
And what did those help with?
They directly lowered out-of-pocket costs, things like deductibles, copayments, coinsurance, made actually using the insurance more affordable for people closer to the poverty line.
So these subsidies were a big deal then?
Absolutely massive. This was the largest expansion of federal healthcare subsidies since Medicare and Medicaid were created back in the 60s, a really significant investment.
Okay, big new benefits, big new subsidies. Mm. How is this all supposed to be paid for? Where did the money come from?
Right, the financing piece. The ACA included a whole mix of revenue-raising provisions and projected spending cuts.
Such as?
Well, there was an additional Medicare tax levied on higher income earners, a new tax on net investment income, also for higher earners.
Right.
There was the so-called Cadillac tax, a tax on very high-cost, generous, employer-sponsored health plans, though its implementation got delayed repeatedly.
Right, I remember hearing about that one.
There were also some smaller things, like limits on contributions to flexible spending accounts and increasing the income threshold you needed to reach before you could deduct medical expenses on your taxes.
So taxes and fees, essentially.
Taxes and fees were projected to cover about half the cost of the coverage expansions. The other half was expected to come from changes aimed at slowing the growth of spending in Medicare and Medicaid, plus other projected savings in the healthcare system.
Hmm. Okay. Now, it seems like a lot of the focus is always on the coverage expansion parts, but wasn't there more to the ACA? Things aimed at quality or long-term costs?
Absolutely. And that's noteworthy because those parts often got less attention, but they were really significant attempts to change the delivery of care, not just who pays for it.
Like what kind of initiatives?
A big one was the creation of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, CMMI.
CMMI.
Yeah, it was given pretty broad authority to test out new ways of paying providers and delivering care within Medicare and Medicaid. Things like bundled payments, accountable care organizations, trying to move away from pure fee-for-service.
So experimenting with different models.
Exactly. Trying to find ways to reward value and quality, not just volume. There was also PCRI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute.
And their job.
To fund research comparing how well different medical treatments actually work in the real world. comparative effectiveness research.
To help doctors and patients make better decisions.
That was the idea. Though, there was a specific rule saying PCRI's findings couldn't alone be used to deny coverage based on cost. That was a political compromise.
Interesting. Anything else on the quality delivery side?
Yeah, there were efforts to strengthen primary care. Things like temporary payment increases for primary care docs and Medicaid, more funding for community health centers, and promoting models like the patient-centered medical home, trying to improve care coordination.
Okay, so the law passes in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Then comes the massive job of actually making it happen. What were those first few years like, say 2010 to 2013? What were the initial steps and the big challenges?
Well, some parts kicked in pretty quickly. The dependent coverage extension to age 26, that was almost immediate and very popular.
Right.
And the ban on lifetime limits on insurance benefits. Insurers, meanwhile, had to scramble to adapt to new rules like the medical loss ratio.
A medical loss ratio.
Yeah, it required them to spend a certain percentage of premium dollars, typically 80 or 85% on actual medical care and quality improvement, rather than administrative overhead and profit. That forced some adjustments.
And providers, hospitals and doctors.
They were starting to gear up for new payment models coming down the pike, new quality reporting requirements. Lots of preparation.
And just letting people know what was changing must have been huge.
Oh, massive public education effort. Government agencies, consumer groups, foundations, providers, everyone was trying to get the word out. But public opinion was just fiercely divided, really split along party lines from day one. And the legal challenges started almost immediately.
Right, the court cases.
Yeah. And the 2012 presidential election became this huge referendum on the ACO's future. Its survival really felt like it was on the line.
And then there were the technical hurdles.
Oh, yeah.
The websites.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare.gov.
Ugh, yes. That raises a really crucial point about just the sheer difficulty of implementing something this big.
What went wrong there?
Building healthcare.gov, the federal marketplace website. It was an incredibly complex IT project. It needed to connect systems from IRS, DHS, HHS, state agencies.
A logistical nightmare.
Pretty much. And when it launched in October 2013 for the first open enrollment, it just buckled under the traffic. Huge technical failures.
Yeah, that was a rough start.
It really highlighted the unprecedented level of coordination needed across government, with states, with insurers, with providers. And there was this constant tension between the political pressure to get things done now and the need to build systems that were actually stable and sustainable for the long run.
That initial rollout was definitely bumpy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so walk us through what happened once things got going a bit more, say 2014 onwards.
Mm-hmm.
The marketplace is fully launched.
Mm.
What did that look like on the ground?
Well, despite that rocky start with the websites, particularly healthcare.gov, enrollment did eventually pick up.
People managed to sign up.
Yeah, slowly at first, then faster. They eventually surpassed the revised lower projections for that first year. And 2014 was when the really big changes took full effect.
Like the essential health benefits.
Right. All new individual and small group plans had to cover those 10 categories. And the new premium rating rules kicked in the limited variation based on age, location, tobacco, family size, but no variation based on health status.
And Medicaid expansion. How did that roll out?
That was varied because the Supreme Court had made it optional for states. By early 2014, about half the states plus DC had decided to expand.
And in those states?
Implementation generally went pretty smoothly, actually. Enrollment in Medicaid surged in the expansion states. Huge increases in coverage for low-income adults.
What about the impact on premiums in the regular insurance market? Did they go crazy with all the new rules?
It's tricky to isolate just the effect of, say, community rating, because so much was changing at once, new benefits, subsidies, mandate penalties.
Right.
But the overall trend we saw in the individual market was, yes, average premiums did go up compared to the pre-ACA market. But the plans were generally much more comprehensive. Apples and oranges in some ways.
So better coverage, but maybe higher sticker price before subsidies.
Kind of. And guaranteed issue and community rating just fundamentally changed the whole nature of that individual market. Insurers had to adapt.
Did new problems emerge then?
Yeah, definitely. Concerns started popping up about network adequacy. Meaning, were the lists of doctors and hospitals included in these new marketplace plans broad enough? Or were they too narrow, limiting patient choice? And transparency, was it clear which providers were in network? Those became real issues.
Mm. And what about the employer market during this time? Big changes there.
Actually, remarkably stable. The predictions of employers dropping coverage en masse, that really didn't happen. Most large employers kept offering insurance.
Interesting. So back in the marketplaces, who is signing up? What kinds of plans?
Silver plans were the most popular by far, largely because you needed a silver plan to get those extra cost-sharing reduction subsidies if your income was low enough. But even with subsidies, rising out-of-pocket costs, deductibles, copays remained a concern for a lot of people. The ACA provided better financial protection than before, especially against catastrophic costs. But high deductibles were still a barrier for many.
And on the quality side, were those initiatives starting to show results?
We started seeing some early data points. Things like the hospital readmissions reduction program seemed to be having some impact, nudging hospitals to better coordinate care after discharge. But it was still early days for a lot of the quality measures.
So by the end of 2016, before the change in administration, where did things stand?
I'd say the ACA had largely weathered those initial storms. The marketplaces were functioning. Medicaid expansion was covering millions in participating states. The insurance market rules were the new normal. It had established a new baseline, you know. But challenges around cost and affordability were definitely still there.
Okay. Then 2017 hits. The Trump administration comes in. And repealing and replacing the ACA is priority number one. That must have created massive uncertainty.
Massive. It was a period of real threat to the law, definitely. But in retrospect, it also showed how embedded the ACA had become, how resilient it was in some ways.
What kinds of actions did the administration take?
Well, there were a series of executive actions pretty early on, things aimed at arguably undermining the law's functioning. Depending on your perspective, you might call it sabotage or just exercising executive discretion.
Like what specifically?
Cutting funding for outreach and advertising during open enrollment. Shortening the enrollment period itself, expanding the availability of plans that didn't have to meet ACA requirements, short-term plans, association health plans.
Trying to create alternatives outside the ACA marketplaces.
That seemed to be the goal. They also temporarily suspended payments for the risk adjustment program, which helps insurers manage risk, creating uncertainty, proposed cuts to the Prevention and Public Health Fund, and maybe most significantly, they stopped making the cost-sharing reduction CSR payments to insurers.
The payments that helped lower deductibles for low-income people, they just stopped paying them.
Yep. The argument was about whether Congress had properly appropriated the money, but the effect was kind of paradoxical.
How so?
Insurers still had to provide the discounts by law. So to make up for the lost CSR payments, they mostly just raised the premiums for silver plans, the benchmark plans used to calculate subsidies, which meant the premium tax credits actually went up, costing the federal government more money overall.
Wow, an unintended consequence.
A major one. Meanwhile, in Congress, the big repeal and replace drama was playing out.
Right. Those attempts were huge news. What were the main ones?
First, the House passed the American Health Care Act, the AHCA, but it stalled because of deep divisions within the Republican Party itself.
Divisions over what?
Conservatives felt it didn't go far enough in repealing the ACA. Moderates were really worried about the Congressional Budget Office estimates showing millions would lose coverage and the impact on people with pre-existing conditions.
So it died before reaching the Senate.
Well, the House passed it narrowly, but it was clear it faced huge hurdles. The Senate then tried to craft its own version, the Better Care Reconciliation Act, or BCRA.
And that.
Same problem. Couldn't bridge the internal Republican divide. Big fights over the depth of Medicaid cuts, the premium increases projected for older adults. It failed to get the votes.
And then there was the skinny repeal.
Yeah, that was kind of a last-ditch effort. A much more limited bill, mainly repealing the mandates. But even that went down in dramatic fashion.
The famous John McCain vote.
Exactly. His thumbs down ended that effort.
What did those failures really show?
A few things. The constraints of using the budget reconciliation process, which limited what they could include. The power of public opinion, which had actually shifted to become more favorable towards the ACA once repeal seemed imminent. And just the sheer difficulty of agreeing on a replacement plan, not just repealing the old one.
But one big change did get through, right? The individual mandate penalty.
Yes. That was eliminated as part of the big Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. They zeroed out the financial penalty for not having insurance starting in 2019.
Did that cause enrollment to collapse?
Actually, the impact on enrollment was less dramatic than some had predicted, at least initially. Maybe modest declines, but no collapse. But removing the penalty became the basis for a whole new massive legal challenge, Texas v. United States.
Okay, what was the argument there?
The argument was, the Supreme Court previously upheld the mandate as a tax. If the penalty is zero, it's no longer a tax. Therefore, the mandate is unconstitutional. And crucially, they argued the mandate was so central to the ACA that the entire law should fall along with it.
Wow, trying to invalidate the whole thing through the court.
Exactly. The case worked its way up. The Supreme Court agreed to hear it, creating this huge cloud of uncertainty over the ACA's entire future again.
So despite all that, the ACA's core structure survived those 4 years, albeit modified. Hmm. Let's talk impacts then, post-2016. What does the evidence show about coverage, costs, quality?
Well, what's really revealing is even without the mandate penalty, the overall uninsured rate stayed near historic lows. It didn't shoot back up.
Interesting. Where were the gains most noticeable?
Still heavily concentrated among low-income adults in the states that had expanded Medicaid. That state-level decision remained hugely consequential.
Did it help with disparities, racial and ethnic gaps?
There was continued narrowing of those gaps in coverage, which is positive, but significant disparities definitely persisted, and the lack of expansion in some states created that persistent coverage gap.
The coverage gap. Remind us what that is.
It's people, mostly in non-expansion states, who earn too much to qualify for traditional Medicaid, but not enough to get significant subsidies in the marketplace. They fall through the cracks, millions of people.
Right. Okay, what about costs? Did the ACA finally bend the cost curve?
That's complex. Individual market premiums, like we said, were volatile early on, then seemed to stabilize somewhat, especially in states that took action like implementing reinsurance programs.
And out-of-pocket costs for consumers.
A really mixed bag. For many newly insured, financial protection improved dramatically compared to being uninsured. But for others, even with coverage, high deductibles and copays remained a real burden, especially if you didn't qualify for those cost-sharing reductions.
Access to care. Did having insurance translate to actually getting care?
Generally, yes. Access improved overall, especially for preventative services, which were often free. And again, bigger improvements seen in Medicaid expansion states. But problems remain finding providers, especially specialists in certain areas or certain plans, network adequacy issues we talked about.
And quality.
Yeah.
Any clear wins there?
Modest but growing positive signs from some initiatives. The Hospital Readmissions Reduction Program continued to show some effect. Accountable Care Organizations, ACOs, started showing some savings and quality improvements, though results varied a lot. But providers also complained about the administrative burden of all the quality reporting.
Okay, stepping back from healthcare itself.
Yeah.
Did the ACA ripple out into the broader economy, the job market?
Yeah, there's some interesting research there on job lock, for instance.
Job lock.
The fear of leaving your job because you lose your health insurance. There's some evidence the ACA reduced that, maybe leading to more people starting businesses, especially those with chronic conditions and expansion states who now had other coverage options.
What about employers?
Yeah.
Did they stop offering insurance?
Like we said, the large employer market stayed pretty stable. Small business tax credits didn't seem to have a huge uptake. The SHOP marketplaces for small businesses kind of struggled.
And healthcare jobs.
Significant growth in healthcare employment continued, especially in outpatient settings. And again, particularly strong growth in Medicaid expansion states.
Did it make people healthier overall? Less sick days?
Some suggestive evidence of reduced sick days, maybe improved productivity, but isolating the ACA's specific impact on the macroeconomy is really hard. One clearer finding, for states that expanded Medicaid, most studies found it had a net positive impact on their state budgets.
Positive. How?
Reduced spending on uncompensated care, increased federal funds flowing in. It often offset the state's share of the expansion costs.
Okay, the ultimate question then, did it save lives? Improve health outcomes.
That's the core, isn't it? Early studies were kind of mixed, hard to measure quickly, but more recent, robust research. It increasingly suggests that Medicaid expansion, in particular, is associated with reductions in mortality.
Really? For what kinds of conditions?
Especially for conditions where timely access to care really makes a difference. And we also saw improvements in managing chronic diseases, better self-reported health status, again, particularly in expansion states.
But disparities remained.
Yes. Racial and ethnic disparities in coverage and access narrowed somewhat, which is important, but they absolutely persist. Still a major challenge.
You've mentioned the state differences a lot, Medicaid expansion being key. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on how this state-level variation played out? It sounds like a real patchwork.
It really is. Our federalist system basically set up this huge natural experiment. States made different choices right from the start.
Like how they ran their marketplaces.
Exactly. Some states built and ran their own state-based marketplaces or SBMs. Some partnered with the federal government. Others just defaulted to the federally facilitated marketplace, FFM, healthcare.gov, and their performance varied quite a bit.
But the biggest difference was Medicaid expansion.
Unquestionably. That yes-no decision created the most significant divide in terms of coverage impact. Millions gained coverage in expansion states, while the coverage gap persisted in non-expansion states.
Did states innovate beyond just those basic choices?
Oh, absolutely. We saw states get creative. Reinsurance programs became quite popular and pretty effective at lowering premiums in the individual market.
Reinsurance?
Basically, a fund to help insurers cover really high-cost claims, making them more willing to offer lower premiums overall. Some states implemented their own individual mandates after the federal penalty was removed.
Interesting. What else?
A few states started exploring or even implementing state-based public option plans, offering supplemental subsidies on top of the federal ones. Lots of variation.
Can you give an example? Contrasting states.
Sure. Look at California. They went all in from the start. State-run marketplace, expanded Medicaid immediately, actively managed their market. Generally seen as a successful implementation, though still facing affordability challenges.
Okay. And a different approach.
Kentucky is interesting. They had a very successful state-run exchange initially, Connect, under a Democratic governor. Huge coverage gains. Then a Republican governor came in, dismantled Connect, shifted to the federal platform, and later tried to implement Medicaid work requirements before they were blocked by courts. Shows how political shifts impact things.
Or Maryland.
Maryland adapted. They had early website problems, but they fixed them, implemented reinsurance, took a pragmatic approach to managing their market.
So what makes for successful state implementation?
Seems to boil down to a few key things. Political will is huge. Having the administrative capacity to actually run these complex programs, being willing to learn and adapt as you go, engaging stakeholders, insurers, providers, consumer groups, and having adequate resources.
Okay, bringing us up to the present, the 2020s. What are the big trends and challenges we're seeing now with the ACA?
Well, affordability is still front and center. Even with subsidies, premiums can be high in some areas and deductibles. Those out-of-pocket costs are a major pain point for many families.
Haven't there been recent changes to subsidies?
Yes, huge ones. The American Rescue Plan and then the Inflation Reduction Act significantly enhanced the premium tax credits, making coverage much more affordable for millions, at least temporarily. That's had a big impact on recent enrollment.
But the underlying costs are still high.
Right. And satisfaction. It's generally pretty high among people who actually gained coverage, especially through Medicaid or subsidized plans. But concerns about provider networks, are they broad enough? Are they transparent? Those persist. And just navigating the system, enrollment assistance, that can still be challenging for people.
What about providers? Hospitals, doctors?
Hospitals in expansion states definitely benefited from less uncompensated care. But financial pressures remain, especially for rural hospitals. And consolidation hospitals buying up physician practices, merging with each other, that trend continues, raising concerns about market power and prices.
And value-based care, moving away from fee-for-service.
Progress continues, but it's slow. ACOs, bundled payments, they're growing. Results are mixed, but improving. But it's not revolutionizing the system overnight. Adoption varies wildly.
And the workforce.
Still seeing increased demand, job growth across healthcare, expanded roles for nurse practitioners, physician assistants, growth in community health workers trying to bridge gaps.
What about the insurance industry itself?
The individual market seems more stable now than in the early volatile years, but insurer participation varies by region. Medicaid managed care continues to grow. Most Medicaid enrollees are in private managed care plans now, and the large group market is getting more concentrated among just a few big national insurers.
And employer plans.
Yeah.
Still stable.
Large employers, yes, stable coverage offers, but they're shifting more costs onto employees through higher deductibles and copays. Small employers still struggle. Offer rates have declined modestly. The SHRP marketplaces never really took off. We're also seeing more employers, even mid-sized ones, choosing to self-insure.
Okay, looking forward then, what are the potential future paths for the ACA? Reform ideas, sustainability concerns.
Well, the persistent challenges are clear. Affordability, network adequacy, rural access issues, sky-high prescription drug costs, underinsurance, even among the covered, those are the targets for reform.
What kinds of reforms are being discussed?
Lots of ideas floating around. Various proposals for a federal public option, letting people buy into a Medicare-like plan or a Medicaid buy-in.
Expanding existing public programs.
Right. Or even bigger ideas like lowering the Medicare eligibility age or full Medicare for all, though that's obviously a much larger debate.
Or there's smaller, maybe more bipartisan ideas.
Potentially. Things like strengthening enforcement of mental health parity laws, finding ways to further support value-based care, improving health IT interoperability so systems can talk to each other, maybe further action on drug prices, though that's always contentious.
And long-term sustainability, what are the big factors?
Keeping the insurance risk pool stable and balanced is key, depends on enrollment mix, any future mandate enforcement. Controlling overall healthcare cost growth remains the fundamental challenge for the whole system, not just the ACA. Demographic shifts, like the aging population, play a role. And of course, the political climate. Future elections could always bring major changes.
Let's bring this down to a specific state again. Wisconsin seems like an interesting case. How do they handle the ACA?
Yeah, Wisconsin is unique. They made a different choice on Medicaid. They didn't do the full expansion as laid out in the ACA.
What do they do instead?
They use their existing Badger Care program to cover childless adults, but only up to 100% of the federal poverty level, FPL, not the 138% FPL allowed under the ACA expansion.
Why that approach?
Mostly political opposition from then-Governor Scott Walker and the legislature to the traditional ACA Medicaid expansion. Concerns about long-term state costs, reliance on federal funding.
So did they have the coverage gap like other non-expansion states?
Not exactly the same gap, because they did cover adults up to 100% FPL. But it created this different dynamic where people between 100% and 138% FPL, they weren't eligible for Badger Care, but were eligible for potentially less generous and more costly marketplace plans, even with subsidies.
A different kind of in-between group.
Exactly. So Wisconsin's marketplace enrollment has its own characteristics. They face ongoing challenges with affordability, especially for people above the subsidy levels. Rural access is a big issue. Health disparities persist.
What policy options might Wisconsin consider?
Well, the debate continues about whether to do the full Medicaid expansion that would cover that 138% group more comprehensively. Other ideas include enhancing state-level premium subsidies, creating a reinsurance program like other states have, maybe exploring a public option, or just finding ways to make transitions between Badger Care and the marketplace smoother for people whose income fluctuates.
Well, this has been an incredibly thorough walkthrough, really covered a lot of ground on the ACA. To try and wrap this up, what are the absolute key takeaways?
Okay, big picture summary. The ACA clearly led to a major reduction in the uninsured rate in the U.S. That's undeniable.
Yeah.
But its implementation was incredibly complex, very uneven across states. And we're still grappling with significant challenges, especially around making healthcare truly affordable and accessible for everyone.
And the state variation is key.
Absolutely critical. The choices states made, especially on Medicaid, created vastly different outcomes. It really highlights how decentralized our system is. So ultimately, the ACA marks this fundamental shift, right, in how we finance healthcare, how we even think about it in the U.S. It's had real successes, but also real limitations. The debate isn't over.
No, definitely not. It's clear the story is still unfolding. Yeah. It'll keep being shaped by policy tweaks, political battles, and just the ongoing effort to fix these persistent problems in healthcare. So maybe a final thought for you, the learner, to chew on. After hearing all this, the history, the impacts, the ongoing challenges, what do you think is the single most critical next step? If you wanted to build a more equitable, more sustainable healthcare system for all Americans, what's the priority? Is it tweaking the ACA? Expanding Medicare, something else entirely. Consider the pathways we discuss, which seems most impactful and maybe most politically feasible. Something to think about. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.